Do you think you'd ever hear a person from the United Kingdom speak like an American? More than likely, that dog won't hunt. And that expression is just one example of the differences between us in the way we speak. We've got trucks, they've got lorries. We open the hood, they open the bonnet. And the differences go way back to before we had cars and trucks. There is a sense of identity that comes with language. And we learn how early American settlers asserted that sense of identity in a new book from our region. It is called Splendiferous Speech, How Early Americans Pioneered Their Own Brand of English. It's by Rosemarie Oastler, a linguist living in Eugene. Try saying that 10 times fast. She has written 4 previous books on American English and a pile of articles to complement the books. Rosemarie has also appeared on many radio shows, including Tell Me More on NPR. Rosemarie Oastler, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
So having written already about American English, what was left to say for this book?
Well, my inspiration for this book, I think, was an 1848 book called The Dictionary of Americanisms by a man named John Russell Bartlett. And I was interested in it because it was the first book that really looked at slang and what you might call street speech and casual language of 19th century Americans and really celebrated it. Because up to that time, Americans did have their own language, but it was considered a little bit less valuable and valid than British English. And Bartlett really celebrated American English and made it seem, you know, as good and valid in its own way as, say, book-learned English. So I started to take a look at where he got all his words from, and a lot of them came from the frontier, from politics, from popular newspapers, and just aspects of American life. So that's what got me interested.
Now, I'm glad you point this out. John Russell Bartlett is not the Bartlett of Bartlett's Quotations.
He is not. No, he was a businessman, a New York businessman who was just one of these self-taught people who was interested in everything. He made a lot of lists. He collected tons of material, and he got interested in American slang and what he called low language, and just collected hundreds of words and expressions, and if not for him, some of them may even not have been preserved.
Interesting that he called it low language, but it wasn't beneath him to record it. I mean, he didn't really seem to apply a lot of judgment to it.
No, he didn't, and that was an unusual thing, because up until that time, there had been a few collections of Americanisms, but most of them were based on, well, what you probably shouldn't say if you want to sound educated. You probably shouldn't use expressions like go the whole hog or use American verbs like to ambition. And he didn't make that kind of judgment. Sometimes he made it for himself. He would label something low language or slang, but he still thought it should be preserved and respected because it was American English.
You know, your enthusiasm for language is infectious as we go through Splendiferous Speech, and I quickly get the sense as you describe the American movement west in time and space that heading west did indeed add a lot to our language.
It did, yes. The frontier has always been a good place for words, starting with Lewis and Clark. And the reason, of course, part of the reason is that people were seeing these new, to them, exotic landscapes, animals that they didn't recognize, cultures that were different from what they'd encountered before. So they needed words to talk about all of that. And Lewis and Clark, in particular, President Jefferson had asked them to record everything they saw in detail, so they needed new vocabulary, and they invented or borrowed or changed the meaning of probably as many as 2,000 words.
Wow. It reminds us, too, that Jefferson, I think, among others, expected that perhaps they'd find 300-pound muskrats and things like that off in the western wilderness.
Well, they weren't sure what they would find, and some of the animals were probably as unusual almost as that, and they really had a challenge to figure out exactly how to name them and describe them so that their picture of them would be clear.
We'll come back to Lewis and Clark later, but Davy Crockett, I want to get in here because he seems to have been quite a font of Americanisms himself.
Yeah, he He captured the imagination of Eastern Americans when he came from Tennessee to the legislature, to the Congress. And people would come just to look at him when he was speaking on the floor because his language was so unusual, and I think he played it up. And other people wrote about him and played it up also, but he gave us words like, or more really more like expressions like bark up the wrong tree, go the whole hog.
Uh-huh. And kind of come to think of it, you jogged my memory that I remember reading about Davy Crockett at the Alamo that when he talked about going on the floor of Congress and speaking for the first time, his heart was fluttering like a duck in a mud puddle.
Yeah, well, that was his type of language, and he also popularized the big boast, I'm half horse, half alligator, and a touch of the earthquake. And people, you'll find versions of that in different places, including the Congressional Record. People were very taken with that kind of colorful. And it was based on living on the frontier, you know, bark up the wrong tree, bark up the wrong tree, sit on the fence, root hog or die. That's one of my favorites.
Root hog or die?
Root hog or die, meaning either you have to get out there and root around and succeed and get your own food, say, or you're just going to die.
All kinds of great stuff in here. We have much more to talk about with Rosemarie Oastler. Her book is called Splendiferous Speech, How Early Americans Pioneered Their Own Brand of English. I noticed the 2019 copyright date of this. Is it not even published yet or officially out there?
It is published. It just came out last week, and the publisher prefers when it comes out at the end of the year to have 2019, but it is available.
Makes it sound newer. Okay, we'll come back and talk about Splendiferous Speech that is new and very old as well when we come back to the Jefferson Exchange with Rosemarie Oastler and you in a minute 20. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest is Rosemarie Oastler, a linguist living in Eugene, who has gone back and explored some of the roots of Americanisms, how our brand of the English language branched off from the English brand. Well, we had different circumstances, a different continent, different animals, among other things, and also a desire to be different. That's why we were here in the first place. The book is called Splendiferous Speech, How Early Americans Pioneered Their Own Brand of English. Lots to talk about here. Clearly, this audience loves to talk about language. Feel free to talk about it here. 800-838-3760 by phone. Our email address is jx@jeffnet.org. We talked about John Russell Bartlett's book of 1848, which kind of got you going on this work here. Now, I wonder how much of a backlash there was, Rosemarie. You talked about how he was okay with bringing in low language and slang, and we really put slang in print with this book. How much of a backlash was there? Did the grammar police come down on Bartlett pretty hard?
Well, an interesting thing is that they did not, and this was also something new. The book came out in 1848, which was a big year in various ways. We had just acquired, the United States had acquired territory from Mexico that included California and some other western lands, and so suddenly the United States, which was much bigger, people were starting to feel more national pride, and I think that that made a difference. A number of the reviews talked about American words are the best. You know, they had this sort of feeling that this is okay now. This is good language, and that was really a change because earlier dictionaries, including Noah Webster's dictionary, which had come out in 1828, got attacked because they had too many American words in them. So his dictionary kind of hit right at a time when people were ready to start celebrating their own culture.
We mentioned Thomas Jefferson briefly, but in his capacity as president, sending Lewis and Clark to the West. But Thomas Jefferson's writing has been scrutinized heavily through the years. And we were just talking last week to Charles Harrington Elster about his book, How to Tell Fate from Destiny. And he points out the same thing you point out here, that Jefferson got put on the rack and stretched a bit by British English speakers and writers for using the word belittle. What, is this a crime against the crown to use the word belittle?
Well, the English were not happy with having lost the Revolution, and they really weren't happy with the idea that Americans thought that they were the cultural equals of the English. And so they really had an exaggerated, I think, dislike of any kind of new American word innovations. So he used the word belittle in Notes on the State of Virginia, his book, which came out, I think, in the 1780s. And what he meant by it was not what we mean by it now, but he meant literally to make smaller. So he's using it literally. Sure. And it triggered this roar of outrage from at least one reviewer who said, "Oh, spare our mother tongue. Okay, you've wrecked things politically, but at least don't attack our mother tongue." And he pretended that he couldn't figure out what it even could possibly mean. And that was a pretty typical English response.
Take the country, but leave the language alone.
Yeah.
This goes way before Jefferson, though, and this is one of the more fascinating things about your book, is that you tell us about, for example, John Smith's contributions way back at Jamestown in the early 1600s.
Yes. Well, he was in the same situation as Lewis and Clark, of course, and he had to have... he had to talk about things that he didn't have any English ready-made words for, and he adopted a number of Algonquian words, all of the earliest words that came directly from North America into the English language are Algonquian, and pretty much all of them were collected by John Smith, and the first one that I know of was raccoon, and he just used it to describe raccoon pelts. He was describing a scene in which he met the Emperor Powhatan, the Algonquian chief, and he didn't know what else to call this animal, these pelts. There was no English word for it, so he just had to take the Algonquian word, and that was one of the big early ways of getting words.
It's interesting, though, because you show us the changes over time from very difficult spellings of the words to things we recognize now, and raccoon's a great example. But it's almost like Law and Order spelling squad. At some, we're on the trail of figuring out what we're going to end up with. And for example, the word caucus goes through several different versions.
Yeah, well, John Smith had a good ear, I think, and he was very observant, and he was trying to really copy the Native American way of pronouncing it. But, of course, after a while, Americans just made it more and more look like an American word. And raccoon started out with a very long, something like raro coombs, and then just got shorter and shorter until it got into raccoon. And caucus was the same way. It started out as this long word, something like caucasawa, and just got chopped off. So that was not that unusual either to try and Americanize spellings, and which we also did later, of course, for certain European words. We adopted a number of Spanish and French words and sometimes, respelled them.
All kinds of influences that are brought up in Rosemary Oastler's book. She's our guest on The Exchange, a linguist living in Eugene. Her book is Splendiferous Speech, How Early Americans Pioneered Their Own Brand of English. Elsewhere in the colonies, Rosemary, the people we call the Pilgrims, I'm glad you bring this up, they didn't use that term themselves, did they?
No, they didn't. That didn't come up until sometime in the 19th century, I think, with Daniel Webster started talking about the Pilgrim Fathers. They did not consider themselves pilgrims, particularly. It comes from a passage in the Bible of being sojourners and pilgrims, but they didn't see themselves that way exactly.
Well, they came ashore with their own language in transition, you point out. I mean, what was going on with the English language as they spoke it in the early 1600s?
Well, of course, if you when two groups of people are separate, two people who have the same language are separate for a number of years, they are going to start speaking differently. So language started evolving slowly, but right away, as soon as people settled permanently in North America. So by the time of the Revolution, the people in places like Massachusetts and Jamestown would have really been speaking something that sounded somewhat different from British English.
Well, and you mentioned words that were used around that time that fell off over the years. Things like doth and hath, and you know, he speakest, but the pronunciations were changing too.
They were, yeah, they were evolving at the time, and in some cases, Americans kept the old pronunciation, and the English moved on. So one good example of that would be pronouncing R's after vowels. So Americans now pronounce their R's, whereas the English mostly don't. And that was a change in England. It wasn't a change in the United States or in America. That was something that started happening probably in the 17th century in England. So just in time for Americans to miss it.
Ah, yeah, okay, that explains it, because we actually talked to somebody else earlier this year about she lives in England, is American, and has tracked the differences, and was telling us this story about how they explained to kids how to pronounce the word castle, and they say you pronounce ca, you know, C-A-R, mm-hmm. and put sul on the end.
Oh.
But since the R is never, it wouldn't end up castle, because nobody calls it a car, it's always a ca.
Right. Yeah, that's funny.
Which brings us to the subject of accents, and Becca in Lane County asks about this as well. She says, I've always wondered where American regional accents came from, and you do tell us in the book that there's a reason why Virginians and eventually all Southerners sound a bit different from folks further north.
Well, different groups of people came from different places in England and settled. So the people in Virginia came from, I think, mostly in southeast of England. And they, in England, there were a number of accents, because English had been established for a long time in that country. And so the longer people are living in a place speaking a language, the more they're going to evolve an accent. So they kind of brought their accents with them. People who settled in New England came from the north of England, so they had a different accent. It's a little bit more complicated than that, though, because Americans moved around a lot right from the very beginning. So you can't really track any American regional speech exactly back to any specific spot in England. All of it is pretty much of a mixture, but that's how the differences got started.
It's fascinating, too, when you point out that, for example, upstate New York had a pretty good-sized collection of Welsh speakers for a time, but as they you know, got into the state and the country longer and longer and were surrounded by English speakers, they adapted, too.
Yes, and that was true for some other languages. Dutch was, of course, the Dutch were in New York first before the English. And Dutch was spoken in New York well into the 19th century. German, there was a lot of German spoken in different places on the East Coast. So there were these other competing languages, but they were never large enough to really seriously compete with English.
We're talking to Rosemary Oastler, a linguist living in Eugene, about her book, Splendiferous Speech, How Early Americans Pioneered Their Own Brand of English. And it's a good guide to how it is that our language ended up so different from what is spoken in the United Kingdom of Great Britain and Northern Ireland. You can join the conversation on the exchange by phone, 800-838-3760. Your ideas for things that we say differently from the British and questions about how we got there are welcome. 800-838-3760. email address jx@jeffnet.org. Scott in Ashland says, isn't root hog or die now the motto of public radio in the era of declining government support? Well, perhaps, Scott. Thanks for the observation there, for coming into that expression. You do demonstrate the moving of our English away from theirs in one person's work, and that's George Washington's diary. This was fascinating stuff.
He used Americanisms, and he used old-fashioned words, but still, he was an educated person, of course, and he was still using British literary English at the same time. And that was typical, that people were developing, Americans were developing their own words and so on, and at the same time, they were hanging on to words that that the English had given up. So a good example of that is fall for autumn. Everybody thinks of that as an Americanism, but actually that was a British word, but the British quit using it, and Americans just stuck with it.
Interesting. So all right, we did use the same word at one time, but they're the ones who stopped, and we kept up with what was going on.
Wow. Yeah, you tend to think that the changes all would have come in the new location, but that actually wasn't true. A lot of innovation was happening in England, so the two languages were separating because both sides were doing different things.
Let's come into not just accents, but word choice and how they can be different. I mean, we point out some distinct regionalisms here. And so why Appalachia in particular has some very different words and sounds? Who were the people who brought those words and sounds?
Well, those people came, most of them came from Ulster, Northern Ireland, or from the northern part of England. And they were a close-knit group. They were mostly Presbyterians and settled in the backcountry and in the Appalachian Mountains, and were somewhat more isolated than some of the other groups that settled here. So they were able to keep a number of their archaic words a little bit longer than some other people, and they have a distinctive accent. I have to say that, you know, there is this idea that maybe they're still speaking like Elizabethans. They are not.
Okay.
Nobody is speaking like an Elizabethan anymore.
There's no Shakespeare time capsule in Appalachia then, huh?
Yeah, so there's no time capsule there. Language changes there just like everywhere, but they were a little more isolated, so they did develop more of a distinctive way of talking.
You've already mentioned the fact that we did adopt words from other languages, French and Spanish, because there were people speaking those languages on the North American continent as the British, the English-speaking colonies were growing up. Mm-hmm. You mentioned Dutch already, but here's where you get to an explanation for the word Yankee that I had never heard before. Tell us about that.
Oh, yeah, that's an interesting one. Well, this is, it's not my theory. It's the theory of a linguist, and I think that most people think it's a good one. It appears to have come from the Dutch word Janke, J-A-N-K-E, which would be interpreted Little John. And the English at the time were known by this nickname of John Bull that kind of represented a typical Englishman, beef eater, pipe smoker, you know, sort of Englishman. And, of course, the Dutch didn't like the English much because the English had come over and taken away New York. So there was some hostility there. So they referred to the English in America as Yonkers, Little Johns, like Little John Bulls. And then the English themselves took it up during the Revolution, or right before the Revolution, they started calling Americans Yankees, which was an insult.
It's interesting that it was not a compliment when first used, and south of, I'd say, the District of Columbia, it's still not really a compliment.
No, well, it started out just meaning New Englanders, and then it's got to mean all Americans. And the English think of Yankees as all Americans. And, of course, during the Civil War, Yankees got back to meaning, you know, New Englanders or Northerners.
So you mentioned in the book visitors from England who came over in the 18th century, and it sounds like they were impressed a bit about American speech and made some observations about it.
Well, there were not as many dialects America because people hadn't been settled as long as they had been in England. And in England, there could be much dialectal difference just within a very short distance. And so they were impressed by the fact that Americans tended to sound a little bit more alike, and also that they sounded, on the whole, a little bit more educated. And Americans were literate. They were pretty literate for the time. They were more literate probably than Americans of the same class were probably more literate than their English counterparts. So that impressed English travelers.
That was the big thing that struck me, the idea that because there was no aristocracy, there was no aristocratic speech patterns. And so the differences from top to bottom in class in America were not reflected greatly, at least at that time, in language.
That's right. Yeah, the different accents, you couldn't pinpoint where people fell, on the social scale so much by their speech.
No, indeed. The book is called Splendiferous Speech, How Early Americans Pioneered Their Own Brand of English. It's the work of Rosemarie Oastler, who is a linguist living in Eugene. She's written four previous books on American English and a bunch of articles as well. She's been on Tell Me More on NPR and other radio shows. And we're going to talk more with her about how our language got so different from what's across the pond. And I don't know who that expression is. We'll find out in just a moment. Come back to the Jefferson Exchange in just a moment as we talk more with Rosemarie Oastler and take your phone calls and emails discussing splendiferous speech. Back on the Exchange in a minute 20. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We are talking about language and how the language that we speak, it is English, but how it ended up different in America from what is spoken in England and Scotland and Northern Ireland, and Ireland too for that matter, and other places in the world that speak English. Well, we were separated geographically, certainly, but it was a little more activist than that, as implied by Rosemarie Oastler's book, Splendiferous Speech, How Early Americans Pioneered Their Own Brand of English. We were our own set of people and obviously split off from England after a while and developed our own way of saying things. You can join the conversation as we talk about language here on The Exchange, 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So we're talking about the fact that that visitors from England in the 1700s, late 1700s, observed that there wasn't that much difference top to bottom in how people spoke the language in America, because we didn't have an aristocracy, for example. Now, after independence, it appears, as you point out, there was some jockeying for standards in our language. Who led the effort, and what were they trying to do?
Well, there was some issue of how much we really wanted to sound like the English. There was a lot of nationalist feeling, of course, right after the Revolution. But most people agreed that, practically speaking, we were going to have to talk English. But how were we going to approach that? And a number of leaders, John Adams was one, for example, thought that we should establish a kind of standard that people could look to. And he wanted to establish maybe even an organization where people could borrow books and dictionaries and make sure that their English was polished. And there was some sort of notion that Americans could really polish the English language and bring it to perfection. Somebody who didn't quite take that approach was Noah Webster, who was the Webster who wrote our first dictionaries. And he really believed more in that Americans should set their own standards and that they shouldn't look to the English for standards, that they should decide what sounded best in the United States. And he believed in any words that we had made up, that because they were useful, he thought they deserved equal respect. So his idea was, let's Americanize English, and that was really the impetus behind his dictionaries.
So I'm curious then to know what the British made of what we had done to the language, the famous Dr. Samuel Johnson specifically.
Well, he was very contemptuous. he didn't approve of Americanisms, and it was perhaps partly opposed, but people in England who read anything that had come out of the United States, like Thomas Jefferson's books, always made a point of insulting Americanisms and suggesting that they were they hadn't been tested by time and received, you know, the stamp of approval by British critics, who were really the ones who counted.
Ah, so if the Brits thought it was appropriate for the language, that was okay. But the Americans really couldn't be authorities, it sounds like, in Dr. Johnson's view.
That was the view. Americans hadn't been around long enough to call themselves authorities, and they needed to be humble. And just because they had, you know, left the country and started their own country didn't mean that culturally they were the equals of the English.
You have just used the term Americanism, and it's actually about this point of the book that we first get the first use of the term Americanism. Who coined that? Do we know?
Yeah, it was, of course, you know, his name is escaping me, Witherspoon, John mm-hmm. Witherspoon, who is a minister, and he wrote, and he was another person who collected Americanisms, and he wrote about them, and he did coin the term, by which he meant a word that had been created, you know, invented in America. But part of his point was to say these are words that maybe we shouldn't use because they are just Americanisms.
And one of the things that comes up in this point of the book is there you do take some riffs on particular words and how we use them. Lengthy, for example.
Yeah, that was it. You know, if you look today if you go on the internet and look for top 10 words that you shouldn't be saying or that people are using wrong, you'll always come up with the same typical lists, like words like decimate, for example, which should supposedly mean 1 in 10 people, and instead we use it to mean a lot of people. So the language critics had the same kind of obsession in the 19th century with specific words, and there was something about lengthy that particularly bothered people because it doesn't exactly mean long. It means something like long and boring. So like a lengthy sermon.
A lengthy speech, yeah.
Or a lengthy speech, yeah. And somehow it's, you know, it's created exactly the way a lot of words are created. That you add Y to a lot of nouns in English, like snow, snowy, grump, grumpy, you know, that sort of thing. And so lengthy, there's nothing really wrong with it as a word, but it just caught somebody's attention, and it became one of the words that critics sort of harped on.
It is kind of weird between that and belittle, for example, how it seems like there are some words that just drive people up the wall.
Yeah, there were specific words that annoyed people, and of course, in the meantime, a lot of words were coming into the language, a lot of names of plants and animals, a lot of words for landscape features, you know, all kinds of things that nobody even really noticed, and they just came into English with no problem.
Well, I noticed, yeah, and you talk about, for example, that we really should be calling them bison, but we call them buffalo because that's what they were called in Europe, but then we call it corn and they don't.
Yeah, well, corn meant something different in England, and it just was a kind of general term for a grain. So whatever was the major cereal crop in a place was just called corn. So they called wheat corn in England, or if you were in Scotland or Ireland, they called oats corn. And when the English came here, they started, for unknown reasons, calling the native grain Indian corn. It already had a name, which was maize. That was what Europeans called it. But I think the reason is that corn was just so central. It really was the major cereal crop, and it was the crop that settlers really relied on and would have died without. So to them, that was corn. It was the way, it was like the English wheat. You know, corn was the American wheat. So they just switched the terminology.
Oh, okay. So the most prevalent grain got called corn. Wow. Mm-hmm. There's a part of the book where you you give us the character Doolittle in the play The Yankee in England. There's some specific observations about language here. Tell us about that.
Well, he was sort of the image that the English had of this kind of big yokel who had, you know, colorful language and said words like, you know, all fired and knocked into a cocked hat and things like that. And he, that was sort of the British image of, you know, they never imagined Americans who spoke in an educated way. That was, he was sort of your typical stage Yankee.
It's interesting because the expression knocked into a cocked hat, I know it was used by George Bernard Shaw in one of his plays, and now that I see the genesis of it, I wonder if he was making fun of somebody.
Well, that's possible, but, you know, the English, they really did end up, in the end, adopting American words a lot of the time. They didn't admit it or maybe even notice they were doing it, but belittle, for example, became a British word that people were using by the middle of the 19th century.
Which I guess surprises me, Rosemary, because, you know, at that point in time, given that it still took weeks, if not months, to cross the Atlantic, mm-hmm. And there was no audible mass media, I'm surprised we didn't get to a point where we couldn't understand each other.
Yeah, well, you know, it could just be that not enough time had passed for that to happen. But there was enough literature going back and forth, and of course spelling doesn't change very much, and it did change some. Americans do have some different spellings, mm-hmm. But it was enough, it was close enough, and we pronounce things enough like they're spelled that I think that kept us from going too far apart.
Because I observe, for example, the fact that while Irish Gaelic and Scottish Gaelic are in some places no more than 25 miles apart across a sea, the fact mm-hmm. is that they're mutually unintelligible to each other now.
But they've been around much, much longer, mm-hmm. and that's why. And they were around when traveling really was hard and people didn't trade back and forth, you know, books. Mm-hmm. So I think that it's just that the split between British and American English is so much more recent, and there is so much more communication now.
Yeah, and interesting, too, that we did more or less standardized spelling. I mean, obviously, we still have the U's, like in flavor and labor in Britain, mm-hmm. that we don't have here, but
yeah.
But a lot of the rest of it is fairly similar.
Yeah, it's pretty similar. Noah Webster was the one who introduced some of those changes of taking the U's out and switching R-E to E-R and things like theater. And so he made some small spelling changes, but for the most part, we spell things the way the English spell them.
Oh, I didn't realize Webster was the one who did the E-R on theater, because the theaters sure fight that one tooth and nail. We have a lot of theaters in the Rogue Valley, and they all seem to spell it with R-E.
Well, I get maybe, you know, there's the idea that English looks a little more elegant still.
That could be. You have to give some points to Americans for utility, too, though. I mean, as we pointed out, you know, words like raccoon and caucus, if native words worked fine, otherwise mm-hmm. there are some adaptations of terms you already knew. For example, like calling a wheeled vehicle with a hood on it a prairie schooner.
A prairie schooner, yeah. Because, well, a schooner, I think schooner is actually maybe a Dutch word.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, sort of taking it and applying it to something new. And Lewis and Clark did a lot of that. They made up a lot of words like mule deer and whistling swan.
So they were labeling the creatures as they were going further west.
Yeah, and they would see something that looked familiar, and then they would put a specific adjective on it so that it would make it distinctive. So with mule deer, of course, the big ears, you know, they could recognize that it was a deer, but it looked a little bit different from other deer they'd seen.
They were rather surprised by moose, too, I notice.
Moose.
Moose.
Yeah. Well, that was a different. That was that's an Algonquian word, so they just adopted that word. But yeah, they were startled by some of the animals that they saw.
So another expression I want to ask you about, Rosemary, though, is a flash in the pan, because I've heard a couple different versions of where that comes from,
mm-hmm.
and I wanted to get what you've got.
Sorry.
No, go ahead.
I think it comes from firing a musket.
Ah, okay. That was the alternative version. I always thought it was gold in the pan, and that the not you know all that glitters is not gold.
Mm-hmm. I believe it's earlier than that. Mm-hmm. I'm just sort of winging it here, but that's what I think. I think it has to do with the powder not firing.
Right,
not
so
lighting,
it fizzles instead of goes bang. Okay, that was what I heard from my eighth grade history teacher. And that's exactly why I asked the question.
Okay, you remembered it.
So, Rosemary, as a linguist, are you completely open-minded? I mean, you just sort of observe. Are you like the Supreme Court of language? You just call the balls and strikes, and no particular judgment implied here.
Well, when it comes to 19th century language, I just love all of it. Of course. As a person who uses language, I have my favorite and unfavorite, new words of modern times. But what I know is that language change is inevitable and a good thing, really.
Is there anything that sets your teeth on edge with a particular use of language now?
Probably the things that bother me would be more like things like when people say infamous when they mean famous, or slightly misused kind of words like saying infer when you mean imply. That's probably my little thing that bugs me.
Oh, and how about hone in on instead of home in on?
Yeah, that's another one. I'm sure we could make a list.
We went through that last week with Charles Harrington Elster. His book is How to Tell Fate from Destiny. Rosemary Oastler's book, copyright 2019, but just released last week, is called Splendiferous Speech, How Early Americans Pioneered Their Own Brand of English. It's a fun read. Rosemary, thanks so much for joining us today in The Exchange.
Well, thanks for having me.
It's a pleasure.